KALW.
And they would get in the pulpit and they would start talking about homosexuality. They'd be in the pulpit yelling and screaming and, you know, these sissies, that's my sweet, gentle, kind friend.
Today, how an Oakland pastor turns the tables on homophobia in the church.
If all it's doing is condemning people, it's useless.
We visit the city of refuge. Then we learn about the Bay Area's long history of chocolate connoisseurs.
Ghirardelli and Guittard have obviously been around for a really long time, but more recently, Cho and then Scharfenberger kicked off the new American chocolate movement.
And we'll hear from one of KALW's DJs, Patrick King Most.
I call my remixes redirections because I'm taking a sample, but I'm adding to it.
Sweet tunes and sweet treats. I'm Henat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. This year, Sunday marks the end of Women's History Month and the Christian holiday of Easter. So today we're bringing you a story about a woman who's leading her church to be a refuge, not just for Christians, but for all people. If you grew up in a Black church, chances are it was a lively place.
Where Jesus is.
It was a musical place, an uplifting place. Lots of singing and clapping. That's how San Francisco's Yvette Flunder remembers it. At the Pentecostal church she grew up in, she recalls pastors and church leaders who were tender and kind and understanding. That is, until one topic came up.
And they would get in the pulpit and they would start talking about homosexuality. They'd be in the pulpit yelling and screaming and, you know, these sissies and fat. You know, and it was like, great day in the morning. Where did that come? That's my sweet, gentle, kind friend.
Well, Flunder herself was, as she calls it, a same-gender-loving woman. Hearing these messages drove her out of the church, but she didn't leave her religion or her love of God. Matter of fact, she went on to become a pastor. She's now Bishop Yvette Flunder of the City of Refuge United Church of Christ in Oakland, a space she founded a quarter century ago to be a church that's culturally Black but radically inclusive. I went there back in 2016.
We have come believing. Some of us, our faith has been tried, and we're not even certain if we still believe.
Sunday service at City of Refuge is a powerful thing to witness. About 60 people sit in the light-filled chapel, all genders, mostly Black. Some are in drag, bright, colorful clothing, high heels, and long wigs. There's some older ladies in wheelchairs, and everyone is focused on the pulpit where Bishop Yvette Flunder is holding the mic, preaching, with the church band off to her right. People sway, raise their hands in the air, close their eyes, receiving her words.
My God, come on. My God has touched me.
Yvette Flunder came from a family of preachers. She grew up in the Church of God and Christ, an African-American Pentecostal organization. Like most churches, her church preached that homosexuality was a sin. She was a sinner. She says the perception of same-gender-loving people like her was
people who swing from chandeliers and, you know what I mean, and get together in groups of five and six and do all the things they want to do.
That was in the late 70s, a time of change, not long after the Stonewall riots and the assassination of Harvey Milk. Not enough had changed yet. Flunder left the flock and immersed herself in social work with the elderly, with HIV-positive people. She couldn't go back to the church, but she says the spirit never left her. Then one evening in 1980, she was driving home from work when, she says, something came over her.
I started to weep. Started to pray out loud, started to pray in tongues, which is the Pentecostal experience, you know. Hadn't done that in years. You know, I'd had that experience, but it had been so long. And I pulled over to the side, and then I heard what was almost like an audible voice that said to me that I needed to surrender. And I said, well, you know, they don't want me. And that was me talking back. So that, well, I'm gonna create a place that will want you.
Flunder joined the Love Center Ministry in Oakland in 1984. She sang in the choir and ministered and was later ordained as pastor, like her father and grandfather before her. She went on to earn a doctorate of ministry. In 1991, she founded City of Refuge, a place to practice the radically inclusive love of Jesus Christ. Nobody, she says, would be made to feel less than loved. And her degrees in theology allowed her to interpret the Bible, not just in an ancient context, but for the here and now, in the language of today.
They said he ain't nothing but Mary's boy. He ain't all that. We ain't bowing. Can't be no son of God. We know his mama pregnant at 14. He can't be all that. He didn't get any respect in Nazareth.
Let me say it this way. My partner and I have been together, my spouse, for 32 years. There is nothing in the Bible about us because we were, for all intents and purposes, impossible. But yet, you're looking at me. I do exist.
But still, not to all churches. Research shows the number of Black Protestants who approve of gay marriage is significantly lower than white Protestants. 39% of Blacks approve, while whites are at 64%.
These gays is going to hell. But I come to bring the good news, even though it's an abomination in the sight of God. But pray that you turn to God. That's what Christ went to Calvary for. He died that you could be delivered, that your life could be changed.
Bishop Flunder says to understand why many Blacks feel this way, especially in church, you have to explore the Black male psyche.
Because men of color have been so emasculated in this society and diminished in this society. And one of the few places where they can feel powerful and strong is in the organizations that were created by people of color.
Like the church.
To be gay, in their thinking, feminized men, diminished men. To be lesbian, in their thinking, masculinized women. Both of which were very problematic, where the patriarchy is frail.
Hallelujah! Hallelujah! Yeah! Glory to God!
This is the quintessential Black church experience. The praise break. For Bishop Flunder, these intense moments of connection with God is what it's all about. A God that isn't mad at anybody here.
If this God thing is not healing people and helping people, if all it's doing is condemning people and sending them to destruction, if there is no way for you to become your best and highest self, then why in the world are we even fooling with it? We need to get out of this list of laws and regulations and move ourselves to something that brings life.
In the City of Refuge, I'm Hana Baba for Cross Currents.
I reported that story in 2016. This weekend, City of Refuge is holding their Sunday service at 11 a.m. And later that evening, Bishop Flunder will be performing her gospel music at Yoshi's in Oakland. Find links to all the details at klw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. For Christians, Easter is a day of rebirth, redemption, and renewed hope. The holy day is traditionally celebrated with church service, plastic egg hunts, dyeing real eggs different colors, and eating lots of chocolates. A lot of chocolate. And in the Bay Area, you don't have to go far to find great chocolate. To explore the place of chocolate in Bay Area history, reporter Asal Ehsanipour went to San Francisco's Ghirardelli Square in this story from 2019.
Earlier this month, thousands of people gathered under the glittering, iconic Ghirardelli chocolate sign for the company's 23rd annual chocolate festival. People like Barbara Durst Taylor, who's here all the way from Riverside.
I am a chocoholic and I love to make chocolate desserts, and everybody, my friends, expect me to make chocolate desserts.
Ghirardelli's story unfolded during the Gold Rush with one of San Francisco's first Italian immigrants. Soon after Domingo Ghirardelli arrived, he realized his fortune was not in bars of gold, but chocolate. He sold chocolate candy and other goods to gold miners. Well over a century later, Ghirardelli's the oldest continuously operating chocolate manufacturer in the U.S., older than even Hershey.
Ghirardelli of San Francisco. We craft the most indulgent chocolate.
Ghirardelli has always branded itself as a bastion of San Franciscan chocolate.
We pour our hearts into every square.
But there is another chocolate company with an almost identical origin story. During the Gold Rush, Etienne Guettard, who learned to make chocolate at his uncle's factory in France, originally traded chocolate for mining supplies. But he returned to France, brought back his own equipment, and founded Guettard Chocolate Company.
We are seeing 10-pound bars being deposited in a machine that's really pretty darn old, but it works really great.
President and CEO Gary Guettard shows me the complex process of making chocolate.
This is where it all starts.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we get the beans from a warehouse over in across the bay.
It starts with burlap bags that stack to the ceiling, full of fermented cocoa beans.
Single roasting of each origin.
Gary explains that here on site, they're then cleaned, de-stoned, winnowed, roasted, and ground.
But after we do the pre-grinding, and it's basically like grinding peanuts. When you grind peanuts, you get peanut butter. And when you grind the nibs, you get unsweetened chocolate.
We dart puddles of that unsweetened chocolate, weave through heavy machinery, and duck under pipes throughout the tour. The space is stuffy until we reach a cool area with finished chocolate chips, the tiniest I've ever seen.
10,000 chips to a pound, so these are little teeny tiny guys.
For years, Guettard and Ghirardelli had factories just blocks away from each other, their smells blending and swirling through the city.
You smelled all of that stuff in downtown San Francisco. You could walk down Montgomery Street and smell coffee or smell chocolate. So that's gone.
Because both companies moved production to the suburbs. Today, Ghirardelli is owned by the Swiss mass chocolate maker Lindt, but Guettard remains family-owned and operated, the oldest of its kind in the country. They supply chocolatiers like Charles Chocolate and Ricuti.
That is going to seize.
Even seize candy. Guettard and Ghirardelli started at the same time in the same place because San Francisco could import cacao along Pacific trade routes. Remember, this was before refrigerators and air conditioning, so San Francisco's cooler climate was key to producing chocolate year-round. Since then, throughout the country, most major chocolate companies ramped up production so much, the flavor of their chocolate suffered. They mostly used cheaper bulk beans, added a lot of sugar, making sweet but bland chocolate. Until the 70s, when Bay Area dessert chefs like Alice Medrich reinvented how they approached chocolate.
Can you describe that photo to me?
That photo?
Yeah.
In Alice's North Berkeley kitchen, she has a framed photo of her slumped in a chair, exhausted after the opening day of her famed chocolate shop, Cocola.
The first day? Can I take a photo of that photo?
Yeah. She's feeding me truffles made with three local chocolates.
This guy's dandelion. This is Guettard. I made very little sugar adjustment in these, and I used a lot of chocolate. So
that's why she's known as the first lady of chocolate. For Alice, it all started with a visit to France.
I had a landlady. We lived in her private home, and she made homemade chocolate truffles for us. Compared to the chocolate candy that I grew up with, this chocolate truffle was like a little bittersweet poem.
Alice tinkered with the truffle recipe back in Berkeley.
And people just went nuts for them.
They were packed with real, immensely flavored chocolate.
It wasn't sweet. I mean, of course it was sweet. It was chocolate, but it was very, very bittersweet, and it melted like satin on my tongue.
Because she used little sugar and no cocoa powder or shortening, Alice credits her success to the spirit of Berkeley at the time.
I think Berkeley was always more unconventional and accepting and curious.
Which allowed for more innovation. Berkeley customers welcomed Alice's European approach to ingredients, which then spread across the Bay Area and eventually the country. The chocolate truffles we eat now, Alice popularized them first. Back in the 70s, Alice helped change the scene by the way she used the chocolate. She says it paved the way for another chocolate revolution in the 90s, which innovated the chocolate itself.
Yeah. So, yeah, see, it's just endlessly interesting. It's like a whole new world of interesting.
So this is what you meant about, like, just sort of picking things up and experimenting.
Yeah, I mean, the whole new, this sort of what I like to call the second wave of this chocolate revolution, where it's all about the chocolate, is just, it's endlessly complex and interesting. Mm. It's a whole, like, it's like Disneyland of flavor.
What brought on this new wave of chocolate innovation? A company called Scharfenberger. When a doctor named Robert Steinberg got diagnosed with cancer, he left his career and pursued a passion for fine food. He convinced his friend, winemaker John Scharfenberger, to join him.
He showed me a picture of this little chocolate factory he had worked in Lyon, called Bernichon. And I looked at that and I said, oh, we can do that.
People now compare artisanal chocolate to fine wine all the time. But back then, Scharfenberger broke ground by focusing on flavor, loading their bars with cacao, chocolate's main and most expensive ingredient.
No one ever talked about cacao, ever.
So, he says, Scharfenberger taught their consumers, even bringing cacao beans to trunk shows.
Everybody was like, what? What's that? People were grabbing them and eating them as if they were almonds. I said, no, their shells are on them, or whatever.
Unlike other American mass chocolate producers, Scharfenberger plastered cacao percentages on their packages. And other chocolate manufacturers had a Willy Wonka approach. No one knew what happened behind closed doors. So when Scharfenberger opened their Berkeley factory to the public, it was a revelation.
The transparency that was common in the wine business, I just transferred it to us.
Asal reported that story in 2019. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. This month, KELW launched a new show about music discovery called On Repeat. Every Friday, host Sheho Letsoalo talks to KELW DJs about three songs they can't stop listening to. Tomorrow's episode features KELW DJ Patrick King Most, also known as Patrick Diaz. Next, we'll hear how his DJ lineage can be traced all the way back to his seventh grade dance. I sat down with him to learn what inspires him and his music selection.
Growing up, what kind of music did you listen to? What kind of music was around you in your house?
Musically, my diet was really focused on 90s hip hop. Tropical Quest, Gangstar, New York, Far Side, and Freestyle Fellowship in LA. But really, I think locally, it was my older brother who was a DJ, also other mobile DJ groups that were kind of out there throwing parties. So that's how I got involved so early as a seventh grader DJing my own dance.
So seventh grade, where?
This little like private school called All Souls is a Catholic school, K through eighth, you know, very Latino thing. You send your kids to, you know, Catholic school. And I think we're all just kind of like kids of the time, just listening to music. It was a super diverse school. So I had not just, you know, ethnically, but also class wise. So I kind of like soaked in a lot of different culture and music and opinions. It kind of like really, you know, gave me a very expanded view of what things can be, not just musically, but ethically as well. Mm. So, yeah.
So that's seventh grade. What happens after that and into high school in terms of your music journey?
It, you know what? I continued it and kind of like through high school, I wasn't the best student. And I think that's because I was unfortunately focused on music and all that stuff, which is a kind of typical story. It's for a lot of people.
So, I was going to say, what did mom and dad think about it and the Catholic school people?
Yeah, my parents, we are very close and they never really were against it. They just wanted to make sure I do something with it. Or I just, you know, the kind of typical immigrant parent, like we came to this country, we want you to, you know, succeed and do better than us.
I can totally relate coming from, you know, a child of immigrants myself. There was always this, you know, a lot of children of immigrants talk about this pressure, right? Like it's kind of, you know, your parents want you to be the doctor, the engineer, the lawyer or something, you know, the professions that they know will bring security. So I can't, you know, you get that as a child of immigrants. But then when you go into these creative arts, it really has to be something that they feel will help you have that security in your future, right?
100%. Yeah. Yeah. And I think also that's just kind of how I carry myself too, that kind of child of immigrant scarcity sometimes, you know, like, you know, you want to like, oh, I don't, if I do this, I'm not going to be able to do that. But I think that gets shedded away in time as you become more of a confident artist and you embrace what you're doing.
Can you tell us how you settled on the name King Most? I mean.
Yeah. How I settled on the name King Most.
That's a big name.
I know. It's a very big name. I used to like make up stories of why I got that name because the original story I thought was so stupid and silly. But it's the truth. So I just tell people,
What is the story?
I just needed a cool name for a little flyer. My friends, little idiot friends were having a party and I needed names for the flyer. I was like, yeah, let's go with that. That works. I'm sure this is not going to be something I'm dealing with 20 years, 15 years down the line. But yeah, and I think now, the reason why I'm adding Patrick King Most, because I think the King Most part is just the DJ club producer. But I think with the Patrick, it's more acknowledgement of just me as an artist in general and just embracing, you know, I'm a creative person, not just as a club DJ.
So we talked about seventh grade, we talked about high school.
Parents,
so you grow up and then, you know, when do you really get into music and what was your first DJing gig and what was it like?
Besides that seventh grade dance, which I bombed, like I had like 20 records at the time.
What music did you play?
I think the hottest thing I had was maybe some Janet Jackson, like the one with Q-Tip. Yeah, but you only have, when you got like, you know, a whole night, you only have so many records.
So why you want to go and do that? Love,
yeah, that
huh?
one with Dilla.
So
yeah,
why
yeah,
you
yeah,
go
yeah.
And do that.
After a certain time, you're like, okay, I got nothing else. And also, yeah, I mean, I was very, a little stubborn and hard headed with what I felt I should play at a party and what people should listen and dance to. So.
What was the difference between the two? What did you think was right? And what did people want to listen
to? I was playing like, you know, Tribe and Groove Theory and like D'Angelo and, you know, things like that. My friends, they wanted to hear like, you know, whatever was popping at the time. So I think Nelly, you know, Puffy, all that stuff. At the time, when you're from like the underground, you're like, oh, that's the worst. But if you kind of like, you know, you become a little more open-minded and listen to things in context, you're like, this is like, I get why this bangs still. I get why people like it. So yeah, it was a learning lesson. I think at that point, I understood how the general public listens to music, how they enjoy it. They want to connect with things. It's not all about me. It's about the greater good, the community in this space.
So it's really an art of generosity.
Yeah, there is a lot of art and generosity. It's the art of generosity in DJing and also a spirit of service, a spirit of community. Mm. So yeah, it's been a lot of work, but I think that's part of an artist. You just grow and you have to kind of like flop and bomb to really learn like, oh, this is how I'm going to get better is by kind of sucking, for lack of a better term, kind of sucking. So yeah.
How do you find new music? Where do you find it? Where do you go?
There's, you know, a little bit of like, you know, going on like the big sites and looking, letting the algorithm kind of help you along. But I like to kind of do it that way, but also friendship, going to the record store, listening to others. Also just kind of like, you know, I've heard of this artist a lot. I should know about them at least. And if I don't like their music, I should at least educate myself and maybe I'll find something like, oh, this is actually good or this surprised me and all that stuff. So it's a myriad of ways. I'm not ashamed to Shazam a DJ set or be at a coffee shop and be like, hold on, just standing here like a weirdo with my phone up. Any which way you can find new music, I'll do it.
What can we expect from you on your DJ sets on KALW?
So for my KALW DJ sets, I think listeners, I hope they're okay with getting a very wide range of music. And it's going to be techno, indie rock, a lot of R&B, 70s obscurities to reggae to, you know, I like to think I want to do a show where I can have Billie Eilish, D'Angelo, Roy Ayers, all in the mix. And it makes sense if you are a music lover and you're curious about learning more music.
It's KALW here with your boy, Patrick King Most. Underneath us, we have Gary Davis with the song simply titled GD.
That was an excerpt from my conversation with KALW DJ Patrick King Most, and he'll be featured on tomorrow's episode of On Repeat, which airs Friday on KALW. He'll be sharing three songs he can't stop listening to, and you'll hear stories about what makes each selection special to him. And as always, catch him spinning on our airwaves every Tuesday from 10 to midnight. Today's Cross Currents team includes Steffi Puerto, Cheryl Kaskowitz, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, Sunni Khalid, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.